I've a long time looked forward to having the opportunity to speak to you in this Crotona school, because I really think it's doing a magnificent work. And I think it's just marvelous to be here and to talk to you all. Now, the series I'm giving of 8 talks are really covering the field of theosophy, but the field of theosophy that interests me. I'm choosing the bits that I think are important and will dwell mostly on those, and some will be excluded. So the first 4 talks will deal mostly with what we might call the framework of theosophy, and the last 4 will get into the ethical field. Because no philosophy of life and no search for meaning in life has any value until it leads into the ethical field. And actually, you will probably find as I go along that that which I'm talking about today, the wonder of oneness, does introduce us to the ethical field. It's the basis of the ethical field. Now, in your notes, you will see I'm going to have trouble reading, I think, but thus I'll have to bend down a bit. Theosophia was the word that was used by Ammonius Sarkis in Alexandria to describe what he called the quintessence of all religious thought. I won't go into this, but you probably all know this. But then in the Key to Theosophy, HPB goes on to say that Theosophia was the divine wisdom, or the wisdom of the gods, or the wisest of men. Now, we're not really, are we, the wisest of men? So we have actually available to our understanding only a portion of that which is really Theosophia, the lifting of the veil, the corner of the veil only has been lifted, HPB said. So therefore, Theosophy is a search. It's a search for the rest of the philosophy which is hidden behind the veil, and it is revealed as more of the corner, can I say more of the corner, of more of that which hides the true, our true understanding of theosophy is revealed. So we have a search. Now I'm not going to deal with details, I want to deal with principles. Because the principles are that which is important. Now, some time ago, or it isn't, it's only a few months ago, I was asked to provide a definition of the principles of theosophy which could be read to a person meeting theosophy for the first time and be understood by them. Now, this is a real challenge. I know the students in this class have had this sort of exercise put to them. And I'm going to read these principles, these basic principles to you, and once, and I'll read them again at the end of the course. And in between times, you can work out what you think are the basic principles. They're based, of course, on the 3 propositions of the secret doctrine. Everything that exists is one great all-embracing energy field in which we live and move and have our being. We can look upon this wholeness as nature or as God, not as a personal being, but as a God within all his manifested world and not apart from it. Spirit, or the true self in man or woman, is one with this wholeness. He is seldom aware of his potential divinity because his self-centered, thought, feeling, activity, his self-centered thought, feeling, activity, has built up a personality or mask which almost entirely shuts out the spiritual nature of the person. And thirdly, the life process is a return to the wholeness which is God. In this evolution of spirit, which includes, of course, the evolution of matter, man increasingly expresses his divine nature in his life as a result of lessons learnt in the physical world of limitation and suffering. These principles make it clear that everything in the world is interconnected in the same way that everything is interconnected in an ecological system. From this flows the need for every human being to accept responsibility for his own life and his own actions, and to live with a sense of reverence for all forms of life, compassion for all beings, and a loving and caring attitude towards all humans he comes in contact with. Now, if we accept these principles as basic, then the concepts of reincarnation, karma, the bodies of man, the rounds and races, and all those things become the mechanics of the process, and therefore, my point of view, less important. They are only the mechanics of the process in which life is expressed more and more as a wholeness or perfection. And that's an interesting way of looking at it. It's put some of these concepts in a different relationship to the whole concept of theosophy. Therefore, we start with the concept of God, God energy. God, therefore, can be conceived as one great energy field in which everything exists. Not only the visible world, but also the invisible realms, and even spirit itself, are all this oneness which we can call God energy, a term that is being used a great deal nowadays in movements often outside the society. You may have heard the story, but some may not. There was a little child, forward child, her name was Jessie, and she drew a picture at school, brought it home to show her mother, and the mother looked down and said, "Well, Jessie, what have you drawn?" And Jessie said, "I've drawn a picture of God." But the mother said, "But nobody knows what God is like." "Oh," said Jessie, "but they do now." Anyway, to get on to the more serious side. In his book, The Atman Project, Ken Wilber indicates his personal belief that each one of us has deep down inside ourselves an unconscious, subconscious, or intuitive understanding that we are part of the whole, that we have in us the Atma, the divine will, which is part of the whole, and that we carry this throughout life, possibly as the will to live. And it is this recognition that there is in each of us this Atma that gives a sense of wonder to life. There have been periods in the history of the world when there have been ages or sort of at climaxes to the development of civilization. Greece was one, but the one I'm going to mention is the Elizabethan era, because that sense of oneness was there at that time. Now, the men of that time, especially the soldiers and the sailors, were ruffians in our sense of the word. They had very little of this sense of compassion and reverence for life, but they had a tremendous zest for life, and an understanding of the cultural values in life. There we get the poetry and the writings of Shakespeare and of Bacon and many others. So at that time in the world's history, there was this sense of wonder which expanded them or allowed them to expand in a greater field of activity than that which is normal in the history of the world. And they became, to a greater extent, part or in harmony with the energies of nature. And the talks we had from Roger Jones will give you some concept of how we have to, in this day and age, move away from the head learning of the scientific era to the heart learning that has always been a feature in Eastern philosophy. So in the course of this search for meaning in life, the key to the whole of our search is the concept of oneness or wholeness. And to follow the search, we must let go of all our preconceived ideas, all of our conditioning. And this includes even our conditioning in the presentation of theosophy that we have endured, we have enjoyed, whichever you like, over the last years where we have been in contact with the society. Because you know, in theosophy there are many ways of looking at things, and some of the ideas have been presented to us as half-truths, in some cases almost misleading. And in my way of thinking, the wrong things in many cases have been stressed, and the important things, like the understanding of oneness, have been left in abeyance. And this is because we have approached it from the point of view of head learning, analysis, all the division into the planes, which I'll talk about in the future series, in the third or fourth of the series, all this division into planes is just dividing things up that cannot be divided. They're a continuum. They're not planes. You see, we've used this analytical mind and applied it to theosophy, which was the worst possible way of approaching the whole subject. This is because we have accepted the duality, or the way of looking at things, accepting duality, in our philosophy. Because man's mind is rooted in duality, the subjective and objective perception, and has for centuries considered himself, a man has for centuries considered himself apart from God, separated from God, or the one reality. He has formed the concept of a personal God with attributes very little different from those of himself. And even today, few of us realize that by worshipping a God outside ourselves, we are perpetuating that duality. Now, this possibly is the Christian viewpoint. I understand it goes back to Aristotle. I don't blame Plato for it myself. But in worshipping a God outside ourselves, we are perpetuating the duality. It's only when we realize that that God is within ourselves that we start to overcome the problem of the dual approach. Now, I'll give you just, before we go on, two or three of the concepts of God that to me are important. First is that God, or the one reality, is all that exists, the visible and invisible, the life and the forms through which the life expresses itself. God is life, therefore, and all the forms through which life expresses itself. All things are God. And then you can take a rather marvelous way of looking at it, that God is nature, the whole of nature, because nature is all. So now I'm going to go through these concepts of God and illustrate them with some slides. If we can now have the curtains drawn. I am without form, without limit, beyond space, beyond time. I am in everything, and everything is in me. I am the bliss of the universe. Everything am I. Can you see the, not very easily. I stand. Nature as a whole, in all her beauty, is God. God is everything. But we think of everything as the tip of the iceberg, that which we know through our senses and our thought and feeling. But it's only a tip of the iceberg. That which is God is also the whole of the iceberg that is below the water. It's a very greater concept than that which we normally accept. The Tao. It follows that the Tao is the center where everything exists. In other words, it's a concept of God that is far wider than that of the Christian world, where the opposites, the yin and the yang, are balanced in a oneness. Because that is the nature of oneness. In every man there is a spiritual component which is the same as the one reality. He is not in us. He is us. We are the spiritual component. I am I, the sense of I am I, stems from this source. We are him or it. And often it's better to look at Godhead as it. Atma, Brahman, God, Logos, the words don't matter. Everything emanates from this one source, the Tao. And the center, this is the source which is the center where all things exist. Then you can look upon it as all our exterior things, our ideas in the mind of God, which is a very interesting concept. But one of the best concepts is of a great force field in which we live and move and have our being. Or if you want to go back to the idea of ideas and the mind of God, then the whole world, the whole of manifestation, is creative ideation. So we have the two ways of looking at creative ideation or an energy field. And in fact, they amount to very nearly the same thing. Now, Shirley MacLaine has written a book recently called Out on a Limb, which I recommend to all of you. In it, she gives some fascinating glimpses of her personal life, including a visit to the Maasai in Kenya, whom Joy will know we saw them when we went to the game park there. They are a native race who live largely, their food consists largely of the blood, believe it or not, mixed with the milk of their buffaloes. And she drove up in a jeep by herself and was accepted by the chief of that tribe and lived with them for some days and presumably partook of the same food. She's done an amazing number of things, including that trip to Bhutan and the book Don't Fall Off the Mountain. But more recently, she's come to an understanding of the ancient wisdom and must have read very widely indeed. Because I'll give you just one extract from that book. which if I was asked to summarize theosophy in 50 words, this would possibly be better than anything I could do. Rudolf Steiner, Ledbetter, spelt wrongly, but still recognizable, Casey and so many countless others, all claiming the fundamental evidence of a divine will, an energy force from which everything else sprang. The divine will was in all living things. Is would be a better word. We are part of it and it is part of us. The task was to find, or is to find, that divinity in ourselves and live by it. Now that last sentence is terrifically powerful when you think into it. The task is to find that divinity in ourselves and to live by it. Now let's go back to our own theosophy and see the basis here. The non-duality of life was expressed, the non-dual nature of the one reality was clearly stated by H.P. Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine. The one absolute reality is all that was, is, or ever shall be, devoid of all attributes, and that devoid of all attributes is extremely important. It is beingness rather than being, and it is beyond all thought or speculation. The Secret Doctrine contains her postulations that of a fundamental unity in all that exists. There is one absolute reality which antecedes all manifested conditioned being. The infinite and eternal cause is the rootless root of all that was, is, or ever shall be. And as you have it here, I think I've got the same on the board. Now in London, in the last years of her life, she conducted a class or series of classes which were attended by, including many people, but one of them was Commander Bowen, who took some notes which were published in that little book, How to Study Theosophy. And I quote from that book, "The teaching is that existence is one thing, not a collection of things linked together." And if we can see the difference between one thing and a collection of things linked together, there is a very great basic difference. Being absolute, there is nothing outside it. It is all being. It is indivisible, else it would not be absolute. If a portion could be separated, that remaining could not be absolute because there would at once arise the question of comparison. And that again is important. There's comparison between it and the separated part. Comparison is incompatible with any idea of wholeness. Therefore, it is clear that this fundamental one existence or absolute being must be reality in everything that is. Now, in the light of this, we should have a look at the Bhagavad Gita. I created the universe with a fragment of myself, but I remain. A paradox. But it also suggests a division. You see where we get the paradox? A division of the one into that which is created and that which remains, which is impossible. Because as she says, it's no longer a unit, it's no longer a wholeness if it is fragmented. So in the same way we have, in the Upanishads, lead me from the unreal to the real. But this again is a half-truth. What we should say is, as Dr. Timely says, lead me to that level of consciousness where the real and the unreal are known to be the same. You see the difference? And in an experience of oneness, they are the same. They are only different because we live in a world of duality. Now, Haridas Chaudhary, who is a follower of Sri Aurobindo, has put this very clearly. Truth is affirmed to be one and universal, and at the same time endowed with endless modes and forms of expression. There is the statement of the paradox of unity, oneness and duality. The destiny of life is affirmed to be the same, namely, union with the eternal. This now dualistic outlook has produced an amazing spirit of tolerance and comprehensive understanding in Indian thought that has not produced the same understanding and tolerance in Western thought. Because the Western mind is only now facing up to the great paradox which this raises. And since H.P. Blavatsky, very few theosophical writers have faced up to this concept of fundamental non-duality. This wholeness is not just a unity of parts, but a condition in which the whole is in the part, and the part is in the whole. The whole is in the part, and the part is in the whole. And H.P. Blavatsky made it very clear that man is part of this wholeness. Man is this wholeness. Commander Bowen also notes these words of H.P. Blavatsky. Man is the microcosm. As he is, so then all the hierarchies of the heavens exist within him. But in truth, there is neither macrocosm nor microcosm, but one existence. Great and small are such only as viewed by limited consciousness. In the secret doctrine, it is made clear that man, in his highest aspect, which is Atma or divine will, is one with the supreme reality, a spark of the universal oversoul. And HPB often made a statement, the significance of which we are only now beginning to understand. We share one consciousness. We share one consciousness. We share one consciousness, the divine mind. But our personality build-ups of thought and feeling give us an illusory sense of separativeness. And we mistakenly think of that which we build up as independent from the One. Now in his book, Expansion of Awareness, Arthur Osborne gives a very interesting example of this. You all have probably seen the puppet show, the Muppet Show. And if you take a character like Miss Piggy, probably well known to all of you, you realize that first of all, Miss Piggy was a thought in the mind of the creator or writer of the show. He then, or she then, was manufactured, as it were, as a puppet by that person and by other assistants. In other words, she is a product of mind, the mind of those who created her as a puppet. But when you watch that Miss Piggy, you can find her in your own mind taking on a sort of a weird independent existence. You see what I'm with? She is taking on a life of her own, which is built upon the thought of the creator, but goes further than that and takes upon itself the need, or succeeds in forming an independent quality, which is the personality of the puppet. Now, the puppet's got no personality. We as viewers create the personality, which was originally started by the thought of the people who created the puppet. You understand what I'm getting at? I'm quite happy for you to ask questions as we go through. I think we'll have time for two sessions to get through the whole lot. Do you see what I'm getting at? This independence which is built up. And that's what's happened to us as personalities. We've built up that false sense of independent existence, whereas we are the product of the Creator's mind, because we are part of that mind. Now, it is possible to experience non-duality when the separative personality is transcended. Non-duality cannot be experienced through the mind because, as HPB said, it transcends the power of the human mind and can only be dwarfed by human expression and description. But the mind and heart can be balanced in such a way as that we can experience unitive consciousness, which is cosmic consciousness. It's just the word they use nowadays. And man can only know himself truly when he knows his unity with the one existence, with all. Cosmic consciousness, if you like a name for it, in this experience the whole universe seems to be within oneself, the whole in the part. Now, this has been expressed very beautifully by a Zen Buddhist. I don't remember his name. I was intensely aware of my body, yet I felt suspended, bodiless, in a new height. Everything within me seemed to vibrate gently in golden light. There was utter stillness. I did not feel the self fuse with the absolute, but it did. I felt the whole universe, everything that is, was in me, was me, for a fleeting forever. It's a beautiful expression, beautiful way of putting it. It was me for a fleeting forever. I haven't found a more beautiful way of expressing that idea. Oh, this is just the southern fjords of New Zealand. Where is the Norwegian? Will they? But this shows you the reflection, the duality in which we live. And in fact, I think you should really reverse it, so that this down here, the misty day, would be our concept or knowledge of oneness, and that which is above is our concept of the world of duality. And this comes from the basic duality of spirit and matter. Spirit is the oneness of the divine will, or Atman, or Para-Atman. And matter is a stabilized form of spirit. I'll come to this later. In the Mahatma letters, matter is called crystallized spirit. And today, scientists realize that matter and energy are interchangeable, but they don't necessarily relate. They look upon matter as crystallized spirit. Matter as form provides the resistance to the play of divine will, and these dual aspects produce a third, and the third aspect being consciousness. Now, I just suggest to you that you think carefully about the difference between consciousness and awareness. Is there a difference? Perhaps we could ask this in question time. So our brain-mind, or the consciousness of the brain-mind, functions in the world of duality. Atma, the true self, and personality, the not-self. The I am, which knows, and the objective world which is known, the observer and the observed, and you remember we covered this ground the two scientific talks we had last week. And this is the world of Maya, the illusory world which is measured out, and that I think is the meaning of the world, of the word, measured out in time and space to provide a field of limitation for the evolution of consciousness, because we need this resistance for the evolution of consciousness to take place. Let us now look at some of the analogies which illustrate how the one, the wholeness, produces this field of limitation and peoples it with units of the wholeness, units of focus, which we have got to know in theosophical language as the monads, the units, the one. This idea comes from Dr. Timely's book, Self-Culture. And I worked it out myself. I produced the concentric rings. They're not quite circular, but... Now, in the center, you have the light of oneness, the source. And each time there is a manifestation of matter, there is a restriction of the light. Until on the outside here, we have comparative darkness or avidya, ignorance. You get the idea? Now we have called these planes, but this should be a gradual reduction of light. However, by doing that, by putting those there, you get an idea of the restriction. The same idea is given in Brother Raja's, C.J. Rajadasa's book, Veils Over Consciousness. A book that has got an awful lot of unnecessary stuff in it, but it's got a few pages of absolutely magnificent concept. That consciousness, that is the Atma in man or in every living thing, is veiled according to the subtlety or lack of subtlety or heaviness of the matter or the material through which the Atma functions. You with me? I recommend that book, The Seven Veils Over Consciousness. It's not very well known, but it's a magnificent book. Because the further you get from the central light, the less you can respond to the spiritual nature, which is the one source. You see the same thing in this diagram. There you have the center, which is the oneness, and you have the yellow coming to the purple. And then you pass a line, which we'll talk about later, which is the antikarana, and then you come into a field of the personality, which is represented by individual spikes, because at that point, the oneness becomes completely separate. And we get lost in that sense of separativeness, which is the build-up of the personality, and we forget the light which is the source of our being. Are you with me? Now, having got a field, then we have to play through it to produce the monads, the units of, or the focused units of that one light. Now if you take a white light and throw it through a prism, then it is broken up into all the colors of the rainbow. And again, if you take an inverted prism, I think they should be closer together, but this is the example, then that colored light is brought back again to the one white light. Now the point I want to make is that in the gradations between those colors, from, for instance, red to orange to yellow, There is an infinite number of wavelengths or variation in wavelengths, do you see? And this is where our individual note as monads, as units of the one life, our individual note is according to that very, very fine difference in the variation of the color. You know these people who do healing by color, they use different colored wools and cottons or threads, and a very small variation in the color of that wool makes a big difference as to which organ in the body or which illness is treated. And so these little variations in color become the individual note or the individual color of the monad, which we are, the spark of the one. And so, and the return path, the path to God, which is the second prism, the return path, then we are taking our individual color or note back to the one source, having worked with it, because man has the particular, as it was reminded me by Virginia before the meeting, man has the particular task of not only of developing himself and of spiritualizing matter, because they are the same. So he, my goodness, a little bit longer, and we have this job of spiritualizing matter. I'd like to take this one. Oh, I've got two more. What is the time? Is it just 40? In this coming together, we are, and this comes from the caves and jungles of Hindustan, of all places. If you take drops of mercury, and you've all played those games where it goes round and round up to the top, or it has to do something with drops of mercury, if they're pure and clean, they will run together into a big blob. But if you put dust or sand or impurity on those little bits of mercury, they come together in an untidy shape and do really not fuse one with the other. So here you see an ethical meaning to this idea of oneness. Unless the individual focus, the monad, or the expression of that monad in the world of the personality, unless that is pure, it cannot become one with the one life. It's very interesting, very simple, but very interesting way of putting it. And then there is the other, and I'll be able, I think, to stop after this one. If you throw a pebble into a pond, everything in that pond is disturbed, is moved. You can do this best by taking a glass of water and drop a pebble or something small into it, and you'll see the level of the water rise. But in fact, everything in the world is affected by every action. Doesn't matter what the sort, where the action is, how the action is done. It just is a fact that everything is affected. And there you have the pebble splashing into the pond. So we live in an interconnected world. And Francis Thompson, you all know, I'm not telling you anything new, but I'll repeat that very beautiful extract from the poem, which is called The Mistress of Heaven. All things by immortal power, near and far, hiddenly to each other linked are. Thou canst not stir a flower without troubling a star. Now, I'd like to say a few words about holism, because it fits in. It's the modern way of looking at non-duality. And it was put forward by General Smuts of South Africa in the beginning of the century, and it was sort of lost sight of for many years. But more recently, it has been looked at again and put forward as a concept which is very much in line with our idea of one reality or wholeness. So that's why I'm trying to use the word wholeness rather than perfection. Perfection gives you the idea that you come to a dead end and reach something that's finished. You with me? But wholeness, you can never come to a dead end because wholeness. So we've got to be careful in our theosophy of using words that are right up to date with the thought of the modern world. So holism suggests that everything we look at in nature is nothing but wholes. Each whole is part of a greater whole, sort of a hierarchy of wholes. Fields within fields, stretching through the cosmos, interlating everything with each and every other. The universe is dynamic and creative. It tends to produce at higher and higher levels, always more inclusive and organized. And that is evolution. This overall cosmic process, as it unfolds in time, is nothing other than evolution, the drive to higher unities. And this is holism. Now, this drive is, of course, Atma, the divine will, whether it's universal or within the separate focus of man or any other form of life. The will to express in life the unique perfection, the archetypal image of the divine mind. Now, I use that word archetype in the Platonic sense, and I extend it in my own mind to say that an archetype is that which includes the whole gamut of a thing, the perfected form and the imperfect form. If you think of a line, the development of the Ford cars right through from the Model A to the present day Ford, you'll see what I mean. There are all sorts of models, all a development becoming more and more perfect, but there is no perfection because the development goes on. And the archetype is that which includes, has the perfect model, but includes all degrees of imperfection. My definition of an archetype, it's certainly different from Jung's, and it may not be exactly according to Plato. And of course, ultimately, every unit achieves unitive oneness, unitive consciousness, when, as the Bhagavad Gita puts it, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea. From the holistic point of view, man is more than a focus or vortex in the great energy field, is no more than a vortex or a focus in the great energy field. I like that analogy because it gives you an idea of the huge energy field, electromagnetic field, but in that there is a vortex, a coming together, a banking up for a particular focus of the individual, of that energy into an individual point, an individual unit. That, to my way of thinking, is the best way of looking at the monad. But because this little vortex is integral with the larger field, man is potentially divine because he is always within that major field. Now, man is Atma, the One, and therefore, through his Atma, plays the will to live. It plays as consciousness through forms or vehicles in physical matter or superphysical matter such as thought, feeling, all of which are the result of motion and vibration and therefore ever-changing. Life is a question of movement and of change. Atma is unchanging. But we, or at least from our point of view, it's unchanging. But at least we can sense it in the changing world as the rhythm and the ceaseless motion of the universe, the song of life. This cosmic rhythm contains in potential all the perfection which will be realized. In this pulsing rhythm is the power which changes the relationship of the fields within the fields and brings about changes which make possible evolutionary growth and transformation. And always, of course, it's the dividing point where you get a possibility of action going that way or that way, which brings about change. This universal rhythm is guided by divine intelligence, which is the agent of Atma. We'll go into this in the third session in more depth. The spiritual will or law of the universe. And when the microcosm man lives in harmony with the universal rhythm of nature, he cooperates in the more perfect expression of life in both himself and in the whole. And that's a very powerful sentence. That's in your notes. Not everything is in your notes, but I think that one is. When he acts from a sense of I-ness, he obstructs the evolutionary process as a whole and also his own development. Now, there's a picture of the river of life which you could read afterwards, but I read this somewhere. It's a very, very beautiful description of the river going over the Niagara Falls. It comes down the bottom and goes through a tunnel, as it were, of rapids, and then it expands slightly into a wider part of the river. I haven't seen the Niagara Falls, but I can visualize it. Now, when it expands, the surface of the water is sort of oily smooth, and you have no increment, have no indication of the power and the movement that is in that water. But as the person who described the scene says, where there's a backwater or a projection, then you can see the swirling and the foaming that goes on where there is that obstruction. And if you see a trunk of a tree going down that river, it suddenly is upturned and disappears right down into the depths, and 300 or 400 meters further down, further down, it comes up again. So we get a concept of the tremendous power of life as a whole. This song of life is not only harmony, but it is a power, and we live in that power. Now, if you take the concept of karma, which is the concept of action, that every action has a potential reaction, and what is important is the way we react to that reaction. Anyway, we realize then that we as individuals, individual units or monads in this great stream of energy, are sharing a common destiny. And as we put ourselves against the current, against the power of the stream, so we create obstacles both to ourselves and to the stream. Minute as far as the stream is concerned, but very devastating as far as we are concerned. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting thought. We'll go into all this, I think it's the fifth session, which is on the laws of life. I'm going to take you to science. Somebody said we have some bit of theosophy after so much science, but I'm going to do a little bit of science too. In his book, The Spectrum of Consciousness, Ken Wilber gives a picture of what he calls the seamless coat of reality. And I was thinking about this. I have thought about this as a ball, a sphere, which is completely without any irregularities on the surface, one color, one surface, one shape. Now, if you had an ant on that ball, it could go right round and round and round and round and never know where it was. Do you see what I'm getting at? And actually, this is the way in which our mind, I think this is how we would feel if we were in oneness. And that is why a person who has had cosmic consciousness cannot express it through the mind, because they're in a sea of oneness that has no landmarks from which the consciousness can be anchored, as it were, or to navigate by. because we need those dual aspects. In our way of, in our level of consciousness, we need these dual aspects. Or you can take it as a ship at sea, when an absolutely calm sea, and a dull night, no stars, no wind, and you can't navigate unless you have instruments there. And that's his concept of the seamless coat of reality. But what we do, we take something within this seamless coat, and it's based on thought, feeling, or physical action, and we build this up until we become aware of it. We make it a landmark for ourselves, a self-created landmark within that sea of oneness. And that's the whole build-up of the personality. And by doing this, we build up obstacles to our understanding of oneness and make it difficult or impossible to know our own true nature, and to know the reality of oneness, the void of the Zen Buddhist, we must get away from our polarity of this here inside me and that outside, the basic duality. We find this difficult. You cannot have one end to a stick. That's something interesting. Have you ever heard this one before? John Coates used to use it. We can't have one end to a stick. Now you can have no ends. That's the snake biting its tail in a circle. But you can't have one end to a stick. You can't have one end to a line. You can have a point in which everything exists. But if you move that point, you create a line and you've got 2 points at each end. This is where we are tied to duality. Now, scientists working in the field of subatomic physics, I'll go through this very quickly because I don't want to get into detail. I've been caught, sometimes I find in the audience there is a scientist and they come at me afterwards. But never mind, we'll go through it very quickly. Scientists who work in the field of subatomic particles have become aware of the interrelatedness between observer and that which is observed. As a result, they have given us helpful insights into the oneness, which is the reality behind human consciousness, based on the split into the subject-object relationship. Now I could have the slides again. This is from Capra's book, The Tao of Physics. When studying matter at deeper levels, the subatomic physicists have find a different world from that which we know by our senses. They could not predict with certainty where a subatomic particle will be at a given time or how it will react. And they can only assess probabilities. And this was a bit of a shock to the world that deals in concrete, this is right and that is wrong. Now moving into an age where we can't say this is right and that is wrong. We have to say that both can possibly be right at the same time. And this is a very great step forward, really, in our thinking. But it's always, these paradoxes have always been in metaphysics. They've always been in the ancient wisdom. And we just have to live with them until we accept them and think about them and gradually see that they aren't paradoxes at all, like the real and the unreal are the same. The particle appears to constitute an intermediate system interconnecting A and B. We have it here. They prepare for a measurement, they make the measurement, and in between times there is movement in the particles, because it's very, very high speed. And so they only find that there is a relationship between A and B, and it is the relationship that they can measure. They can't measure or find out much about the individual particles. The existence of isolated units is doubtful and certainly not significant. What can be recognized as a basic is a basic interconnectedness. And this, of course, is what has been formulated as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. What we observe is not nature itself, but is nature exposed to our method of questioning. It's a relationship between the observer and the observed. Now, we're right back to our fundamental idea of non-duality, where the observer and the observed become one. And the second shock they had, you all probably know this, was the wavical. Wave motion, the sine curve, has a definite rhythm, but they have found that there is a pattern of activity which has the quality of wave motion and the quality of a particle which is stable. And they've called this the wavical. Normally you can predict where a particle will be because it's constant and it's fixed. And you know what a wave motion is. But when you get the two together, there is much more difficulty in predicting what is actually happening. And I'll quote Niels Bohr, the scientist, in describing this. Isolated material particles as abstractions, their properties being definable and observable only through their interaction with other systems. Again, it's the interconnectedness. It's the interactions between them which can be observed. The investigator is forced into seeing the universe not as a collection of physical objects, but as a complicated web of relations between the parts of a unified whole. A complicated web of relationships between the parts of a unified whole. Matter is seen as an ever-changing, always in motion, and always interrelated in its parts. This concept is approaching that postulated by the Eastern mystics, as you will see in the Tao of Physics. But the quotation I'm going to read is from Sri Aurobindo. The material object becomes something different from what we now see, not a separate object in the environment of the rest of nature, but an indivisible part of, and even in a stable way, an expression of the unity of all we see. Now, we get this, this was referred to by Roger Jones, or was it by Houston Smith? So one of them referred to the hologram, but it's in here. I'm not going to take it out just because they talked about it. Now, the hologram, this is the technical way in which it works. It's not very clear. It equals my glasses. Anyway, you can have I have this. I could bring it to the class if you want to see it. But it's a lensless form of photography in which light scattered by an object, that is reflected from the object, forms an interference pattern or hologram, When coherent light is played on the hologram, that's a laser beam, the original wave pattern is regenerated and a three-dimensional image appears. I saw this demonstrated in Sydney. I believe you've probably seen it in advertising. I believe in New York they have the same thing. It was the face of a girl, a very good-looking girl. And when you saw her, when you looked at her like that, she had a sour expression on her face. When you turned around a little bit more, it softened. When you got around a little bit more, there was a faint smile. And when you got around a bit further, there was a radiant smile. So this was absolutely in space. And the coin that they had there was actually in space too, because it's the interaction of these rays. Now the interference pattern is shown there up on the left-hand side. Can you see those sort of circles, which are quite meaningless? Now when you play polarized light the laser beam onto that again, it takes on the form of the original in a three-dimensional aspect. And I think that this car here is one. That might be two, but this, I'm not quite sure what that is. But I'd put this on because it does give you a picture of the interference pattern. Now, the important thing was, and you remember this was said at one of those lectures, that if you take a part of that interference pattern and you play polarized light on it, that part, a quarter was the term used in that lecture, a quarter will produce the whole, but not as perfectly as the whole interference would produce a model. But it doesn't matter. You can take a small portion of that interference pattern and it will, when treated with polarized light, give you a picture of the whole. Imperfect, the smaller the bit you get, the imperfect it is. Which is exactly like my light in the center and the veils round it, you see? The further you get away from the source, the smaller the object, the further from the source, then the poorer the image of the original. But this has been seen as, by some scientists today, as the general pattern of the universe. The part is in the whole, and the whole is in the part. What do we have after this? No, I'll go back. From this point of view, the physical universe is... I'm sorry, I've gone too far. From this point of view, the physical universe is a gigantic hologram, with each part being in the whole, and the whole in each part. So behind or within everything in the universe is an inseparable interconnectedness which can be reproduced under certain conditions. This is called by David Bohm the implicate order. It's as though everything were there in a roll of carpet and the carpet is rolled out and you see the bit that is rolled out, but the future is also in the carpet before it's rolled out. More importantly, everything can turn back. This is the important point. Because of this implicate order, because of this pattern in the hologram, everything can turn back through itself and know the whole. As the physicists found out, for this relationship, the observer to the observer, in this turning back, the relationship between the observer and the observed is all important. And I'm going to read just from a little bit of Spectrum of Consciousness by Ken Wilber. Recall the essential insight of the work of Heisenberg, Schrödinger, and Einstein, that the texture of reality is one in which the observer and the event, the subject and the object, the knower and the known, are not separable. They are one. This type of knowing, which is non-dual, intimate, and direct, does not submit to codification or analysis. Very clearly put. The will Atma, this is from the Zen Buddhist, Suzuki. The will Atma wants to know itself, and consciousness is awakened. And with the awakening of consciousness, the will is split in two, the fundamental duality. The one will, whole and complete in itself, is now at once actor and observed. Man has been thus enabled to see, but at the same time there is something which he, an observer, cannot see, and that is his own true nature. And he can only see it by going back through himself into the whole of which he really is. which is his real source of his being. Ultimately, in a way that we can't understand, the whole, the Godhead, knows itself more fully as a result of the evolutionary process. As we know ourselves as one with the source, with the whole, with the Godhead, so we add something to that Godhead, a concept, of course, that is beyond our understanding. This is the reason, this is the meaning in life why the one is divided into parts, and the return of those parts back to the whole is, if you like, the purpose and meaning of life, the return to God. The white light becoming colored, the spectrum, and the spectrum going back through the prism to the one. We have seen that this duality and limitation, that in this purpose, in this process, duality and limitation are necessary in order that man, the unit of the one consciousness, may know himself one with the divine energy, one with the reality, which is the Godhead. Man's consciousness normally functions in the world of duality, of subject and object, pleasure and pain. As long as man is so divided, he cannot know reality or know himself, as long as he's divided in duality. Ken Wilber quotes the Zen Buddhist, which I've read to you, which expresses that very clearly. Now, how do I get to know myself? The only one answer in the true metaphysical sense. You can look in the mirror as long as you like. You can never see yourself. You can only see the reflection in the mirror. Do you remember the Milford Sound of the cliff reflected in the water? We live in a world of duality and we cannot see ourselves in the physical as well as the metaphysical sense. The only way we get to know ourselves is by getting to know the divine self that is our true nature. We do this by reaching a transpersonal level of consciousness where we know the self, the true self, to be one with the whole of manifestation, whole of life. I don't like that word, manifestation. To do this, one must ponder on this idea of the seamless coat of reality in which there's no duality, and to know the human mind is unable to cope with such a featureless quality of consciousness because it has built up all these signposts of thought and feeling in the world of the personality, which is, and it's reluctant to give those up. The signposts, the build-ups, the habits of thought and action that become our personalities are very, very important to us. And the whole of the return to oneness, the whole process of returning to oneness, is the giving up of that, those build-ups which become our personality. Again, in the later talks, we'll go into this much more. Spencer Brown, the physicist, put it this way: the world we know is constructed in order to know itself, but in order to do so, it must cut itself up into at least one state which sees and one which is seen. And we had a similar quotation earlier. In this severed state, whatever it sees is only partially itself, and in any attempt to see an object, it must make itself distinct and therefore false to itself. And in the mirror, you have here looking at something which is in the mirror, a reflection of yourself, but it is distinct from yourself. Is this difficult? I suppose it's metaphysical in a way. Oh, just this beautiful scene to look at while I read to you some quotations about ahamkara and maya. Now, ahamkara is this sense of I-ness. The sense of I-ness when it's identified with that which is outside you. HPB did not use the words that I was referring to this quotation here, where you have to be split into two, that which sees and that which is seen, before we can be conscious in this world of duality. HPB didn't quite use the same words, but she did explain ahamkara, the eye-building, egotistical principle. And this produces the ignorance or lack of awareness which makes the personality self false to itself, which were the words used by the scientist, and separates it from the universal self. The identification of mind with objects is said to be due to the false impressions which register on our minds as the great unfolding of divine ideation goes on without our being aware of what is happening. The unfolding of the carpet, the great stream of the energy in the river. All this goes on without our being aware of it, or normally not aware. And this is Maya, the great illusion, the measuring out of the phenomenal world to entice us. Interesting word. To entice us into an acceptance of the reality of the objective world. We've been tricked into this. We've been led into an acceptance of the reality of the objective world, and we've got to extricate ourselves from this acceptance. And necessary as this identification undoubtedly was in the earliest evolutionary process, it must, for those who aspire to experience oneness, be reversed. There must be a movement out of duality into non-duality. We must lose our sense of separate I-ness and let it be dissolved in a sense of oneness or wholeness. Ken Wilber sums up the process. Thus, this is very beautifully put, but one thing you must remember if you read Ken Wilber's books, he says that reality is the bottom. We in theosophists say it's the top. Are you with me? Atma is up here with us. Atma with Ken Wilber is down here. So you've got to remember this, and remember it in this quotation. Thus, the real knower is one with its universe of knowledge. Everything you observe is none other than you who are observing it. When you go down to the very base of your consciousness, you put the universe, not the false universe of objects out there, but the real universe, which is no longer imagined as split into a subject-object relationship. Have I read that wrongly? When you go down to the very base of your consciousness, you find the universe, not the false universe of objects out there, but a real universe, which is no longer imagined as split into subject and object. At the very bottom of yourself, you fall out of yourself into reality. Now, it would be better, in my way of thinking, to say in the very depths of your consciousness, you fall out of yourself into unitive consciousness and are aware of the nature of reality. So really, there's no difference between this concept and that which was postulated by H.P. Blavatsky. The one reality which antecedes all manifested conditioned being, which she postulated in their first proposition. Now, in the religions of the world, this experience of reality has been expressed in different ways in different religions. It is the fullness of the seeming void in Zen Buddhism. The fullness of the seeming void in Buddhism, which is very, very near the cloud of unknowing, which is the Christian way of putting it, although that goes back a few hundred years, you know the little book by Evelyn Underhill, The Cloud of Unknowing. Now, knowing doesn't mean not knowing. I suppose it could be being aware, but it's certainly the cloud in which you lose consciousness of the dual world and are aware of the oneness or the wholeness. So the cloud of unknowing is a very beautiful way of putting it in the Christian world. In Buddhism, it of course is nirvana, the snuffing out, extinguishing of the sense of the separate self. And of course in Buddhism, in Hinduism, it's samadhi, which is a more temporary state of that, and moksha, which is a more permanent state. But we know it best as cosmic consciousness, and I'll read some illustrations about this in some of the other talks, cosmic consciousness, or if you like, Christ consciousness, because it is much the same thing. It's an experience of unity and bliss. We can experience this reality in the pauses between thought. In the pauses between thought, when there's no activity of the dual mind, or the mind based on duality. In moments of greatest creativity, in intuition, or that word even, ecstasy, which is used by the Christian mystics. It is only experienced when the everyday mind based on duality is still. It is experienced in the heart and not in the head, because the head separates. The mind is the slayer of the real. Now, I may be putting this too simply, but this is the way it appears to me. All who have experienced this oneness testify that it is a level of consciousness which is indescribable, a glory of light and bliss and joy. Then we'll talk about this later. Now, to experience the one reality, we must live in the present moment, which is the gateway to the eternal. The past, for years and years I thought about this business of time and the fourth dimension, all that thing, but quite recently I found a very simple explanation. The past is just a recall into the present of memory. Are you with me? When we live in the past to us is just memory which is recalled in the present. And the future is just a projection of memories or a projection of the present. It's a projection of memories. projected forward into the future and brought back for evaluation in the present. And now this is a perfectly simple way of looking at it, but when you think about it, it's true. It's only a little split second of eternity that is that in which we are conscious. We're not conscious in the past, we're not conscious in the future. To be fully aware in the present moment, to meet it with choiceless awareness, as Krishnamurti's phrase, is the only gateway we have to reality, and it is the only opportunity we have of transforming ourselves to flow in harmony with the stream of divine life. HPB defines the highest attributes of man as being one with divine reality, a radiation from it, an undetached spark of the divine. But now this was your last page in your notes, I'm going to just mention here, it's really not quite in line, it actually is that which I'll be taking up more in detail in the third and fourth talk. But in the pedigree of man, Annie Besant says Man is that being in whom highest spirit and lowest matter are joined together by intelligence, which is the link, the antikarana between the higher and lower mind, and ultimately making a manifest God who will go forth conquering and to conquer through the illimitable future that stretches before him. So you see, we have that oneness there. We have that wholeness there, the Atman, which is our true nature. And we are suspended between it and the lower center in dense matter. But those two meet in the mind of man. And it's the study of that mind of man leads us to an understanding of the meaning of life, which I will go into later. Now, I've got a quotation here, but you all know it. Shall I read it? I am not this body which belongs to the world of shadows. I am not the desires which affect it. I am not the thoughts which fill my mind. I am not the mind itself. I am the divine flame within my heart, eternal, immortal, ancient, without beginning, without end, more radiant than the sun in all its noonday glory, purer than snow, untouched, unsullied by the hand of matter, more subtle than the ether, is the spirit within my heart. I and my Father are one.